The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Why did Marvin Camel learn to box?
Marvin Camel learned to box quite simply because he had to. He was forced to. His options provided to him by his father, Henry, who was a ruthlessly masculine sailor who also had some experience as a boxer. His options were face the belt or get in the ring. And Marvin was 12 years old, and he was at the Pulse in VFW, expecting to watch his older brother Tommy fight. And Henry essentially pushed him in the ring, and Marvin had no choice.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman. Brian D'Ambrosio is here, and we're talking about his book, Warrior in the Ring, The Life of Marvin Camel, Native American World Champion Boxer. Let's talk a little bit about the sport of boxing. In the 1970s, how did a fighter from an Indian reservation in Montana get into the action?
Well, that's one of the most interesting things, in my opinion, about the book, is that Marvin Camel, coming from the Flathead Indian Reservation and fighting in Missoula for most of his career, went on to become a two-time world champion with very little resources, with few sparring partners. And essentially at the beginning of Marvin's career, he met a man named Elmer Boyce at the Oxford Cafe in Missoula, and Boyce had been a fight promoter. And Boyce essentially kept Marvin as an indentured servant of some kind. Marvin worked for him at Montana Music Rentals, and Boyce built a small makeshift gym behind the music rental store. So Marvin would fix pinball machines and restore pinball machines and deliver gaming equipment from 7 o'clock in the morning to about 6 o'clock at night. And then at six, he'd go into this small room, as one visitor described it, as having all the makings of a kitchen cabinet. And Marvin would spar, and he'd do his exercises, and then he'd go out and do some road work at night, which in boxing term means jogging and running. And that's how he trained. Marvin overcame all these obstacles of, race, topography, geography, and became a world champion. So I think that's really the crux of sort of the inspiration of the book.
Tell us about Marvin's family, because you mentioned racism. Yes, he grew up on the Flathead Indian Reservation, and his mother was Ponderay. But his father was a black man, and that made it even more challenging for the children of this family.
It did. In fact, Henry Campbell's real last name was Campbell, and Henry had lived in the Deep South and dropped the name Campbell and took the name Camel when he came out to Montana. And how he got to Montana is an interesting story, because Henry had been working as a Navy petty officer in Astoria, Oregon. And Marvin's mother, Alice Nina May, had been a Rosie the Riveter type. She had hopped on some freight trains and been a bit of a vagabond, and she ended up welding ships for the Navy. They had met at a dance. They were married quickly, within 6 months, and then they went back to Alice's ancestral land and homeland in Ronan. And Marvin and his siblings, vividly recall the racism, the taunts, the aggression that they had faced, particularly from the Native American community. Marvin in particular had to defend his siblings. He got into a lot of fights. So Henry thought that for the boys in particular, that this would be a way to cross that racial divide. And he used boxing as a way to abate some of that racial aggression. So when Marvin, had been called all these racial taunts and different slurs as a kid, once he got into boxing and people in the hallways and some of the kids knew that he could, clean their clock, so to speak, a lot of that racial aggression, it abated and it went away. And that was part of Henry's plan, to use it as a tool and a form of self-defense.
How do you think Marvin's relationship with his father, with Henry, influenced his boxing career?
Marvin's relationship with Henry is enormously complicated because Henry left the family. He abandoned all 14 children. He met another Native woman in a bar one night in Ronan, and they ended up driving down to Homedale, Idaho, and starting another family. They lived in three rooms, all 14 children. And, you know, there were no leftovers. They were hand-me-downs. You know, Alice worked in the cafeteria and worked in a series and a variety of jobs and did what she could do to provide for her children. And Marvin's relationship with Henry in particular is interesting because Henry never contacted Marvin when he won a world title. Marvin won two world titles. Henry never contacted him the second time. When Henry died, Marvin did not attend his funeral. Most of Marvin's siblings did not attend the funeral either. You know, Renee Camel, one of Marvin's sisters, has said to me, every now and then I hear Henry's name, and I hear some of the old-timers talk about Henry, and they say, oh, he was a nice guy. What a nice guy Henry was. And she looked me dead in the eye, and she said, that's not the man that I remember, and that's not the man we recall. And that's not the man that Marvin remembers. And I think the friction between Marvin and Henry, you know, hurts Marvin to this day. And I know it's had an impact on Marvin and his own three children because he has packed it all in one day, hopped on a Yamaha scooter and disappeared. And he left behind, you know, three children as well.
Mm. You wrote that Marvin, quote, found that he was never more alive than when he was in pain, pushing harder for higher achievement. In that struggle, there was magic, end quote. How do you think that pain and struggle created magic for Marvin out of this difficult childhood situation?
I think with Marvin and many boxers, you know, they're tethered to something purely dysfunctional in the family tree. And they find comfort in boxing, they find a solace in boxing, and when they put the gloves on, they feel as if they're in control of their own destiny. And that's a hard thing to explain, maybe a hard thing to explain verbally or a hard thing to explain in print. But with Marvin and boxing, he put the gloves on. And the first time it didn't work out so well, but the second time he went back and he got better and he got better. And then it became second nature. Then it became comfortable. And then he liked it for a point. He won a few world titles, won two world titles. And after that, his skills eroded and became a sacrificial lamb, the opponent. And boxing is a very sick business. When someone like Marvin, even though his skills were undoubtedly decayed, people use him as a stepping stone. So he fought all over the world for little pay in front of small crowds, getting beat up, you know, getting hurt. At 40 years old, he finally realized that that was it. And even though he had a detached retina, he still tried getting back into the ring, you know, at age 40.
It seemed to me like he was carrying on, as you said, the dysfunction that he learned when he was a child. He was treated badly by promoters. Didn't one of his promoters run off with $20,000 of his money?
I mean,
he had all kinds of terrible experiences with boxing. But he wouldn't give up. He wouldn't stop. And it just reminded me of a terrible relationship where someone is being abused, but they don't know anything else, and so they keep coming back for more.
It is by nature and by definition a very abusive relationship, and I think we might have even mentioned that it was abusive and used that exact word or exact term. But it was all that Marvin knew. It provided a comfort zone. It provided safety. And part of the fascinating psychology of Marvin and other fighters is that they feel safest in an enclosed environment, in an enclosed ring, where they're scored on the ability to harm one another. It's part of the duality of boxing and part of the, you know, the psychological component that I've always been fascinated by.
You're not telling long stories except Marvin's, but the fighters that you mentioned pretty much come from terrible circumstances.
Yeah, there's one in particular that particularly resonates and will always be most memorable, and that's the case of Matt Franklin. Matt Franklin, as a young boy, was abandoned along a parkway in Philadelphia, and the nuns took him in, and they named him Matthew for St. Matthew, and they named him Franklin because he was found along the Ben Franklin Parkway. Doesn't even know what his name is. Never knew. He just knew that his brother abandoned him there because they couldn't take care of him. So Matthew and Marvin fight twice, and Matthew ends up becoming Matthew Syed Muhammad. He goes on into the Boxing Hall of Fame. And I was always wanted to talk to Matthew Syed Muhammad about his experiences with Marvin. Well, I'd found out that he'd been homeless. He went from rags to riches and back to rags. I located him in a homeless shelter in Philadelphia. Got him on the phone, spoke to him, and got a few words from him and a few quotes. One of which we repeated over and over again was that, you know, boxing was no good for anybody. And Matthew died months later after our interview of Lou Gehrig's disease. And Matthew's story is not dissimilar from many other stories. There are many other stories in the book, and I thought it was important to explain what happened to some of Marvin's opponents and some of the men he crossed paths with, and use Marvin as he's a stellar example of a boxer even to this day, and he's a shining example.
Well, as you mentioned, Marvin won world titles. He not only won world titles, but he became the first American Indian to hold a world title in boxing. And afterward, there was a huge celebration on the reservation, and people on the reservation and in Montana had a big ceremony and honored him. But when he lost the title, there was nobody there for him.
That's true. And Marvin, quite clearly in his own words, says that when you lose a world title, you can hear a pin drop. People are fickle, you know, and they embrace Marvin, you know, when times were good, when things were great, when he won a world title, when he was at the kind of the epicenter of his glory and talent and skill. But as he faded from the limelight, you know, the newspaper articles, they went away, and reporters weren't there at the airport anymore, and friends and family just, you know, shrugged their shoulders, you know, after a while, and people became indifferent. And it's interesting that Marvin won a world title, and he lost it in his first defense. And then there was a new division that was created in 1983, and Marvin found himself fighting for a second world title in Nova Scotia, and he won that match, but he went alone. He had no manager, no trainer, no cut man, no sparring partners. He went alone, and he came back from the airport alone with a belt, and drove all the way up to his home, put the belt on the fireplace, and, you know, and sat there. And that was probably, as he says, his most fulfilled and rewarded he's ever been. But so much of Marvin's journey and saga and struggles were solo.
Yeah, he went to Nova Scotia. He was there for 4 weeks training by himself with no manager and no trainer.
And no trainer. And it ended in a riot. And like many of Marvin's fights, they ended, you know, very controversially and in sheer pandemonium. What happens is Marvin fights a guy named Roddy McDonald, and Marvin catches him with a body punch, and McDonald goes down. But to McDonald's Canadian brethren, it looked like it could have been a low blow. So bottles start coming in the ring, paper cups, you know, anything that people can get that's not tied down, they're thrown in the ring at Marvin, and Marvin has to be escorted out by the police. And the interesting thing about that was that they asked McDonald about it later. They said, well, what kind of punch was it? Legal, illegal, fair, cheap? McDonald says, you know, it was a good shot. It was a body punch, and it hurt. So Marvin goes home, and in the next few weeks and months, he starts to get these letters from Canadians, you know, apologizing for their behavior, crediting him with a good punch and a good victory, and apologizing for their boorish and, you know, and rude behavior. So it was actually kind of quite comical in some ways.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Brian D'Ambrosio about Warrior in the Ring, the life of Marvin Camel, Native American world champion boxer. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and hear Brian read some messages that were written to Marvin from school children he inspired. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed and find dozens of interviews with other authors at our blog. mtpr.org/twq is the place to find that. There's also a link to the blog on our Facebook page. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Marvin's boxing career had many ups and downs, but I think probably the worst moment for him, worse than going to Nova Scotia and coming back and nobody being there to greet him when he had a title, was the fight that happened in March of 1990 at the Yellowstone Metra in Billings, Montana. Tell us what happened there.
The fight with Leroy Murphy is, to this day, something that gnaws Marvin and aggravates him. And I thought that the book was part of the healing process because I contacted Leroy Murphy and I put Leroy Murphy in touch with Marvin, and they have a tentative date to actually meet and get together. Leroy Murphy has a sister who lives close by to Orlando, where Marvin's living now. So I thought it was important for Marvin to reconcile some of the misdirected sort of anger he's had toward Murphy and toward the decision. Now, the decision was quite controversial. The referee, Dan Jancic, stopped the fight going into the final round. Marvin had been ahead on all three judges' scorecards, but Jancic saw something. Marvin was a bleeder, had a propensity to cut, and the referee used his discretion. He made a decision. He called the fight off, and Marvin protested vehemently. He protested formally. At one point, he even was showing the video of the fight in Missoula. He would go to these clubs and these bars and put it on the TV set and show it to people. And there were enough people who were concerned by the decision that they protested to the Montana Athletic Commission and the Montana Athletic Board. But the Montana Athletic Board essentially told Marvin that he and his managers approved of the referee, and that he'd had to take it up with the sanctioning body, the boxing body, which was the IBF. So nothing ever came of it, but Marvin held a grudge. In his mind, you know, Montana did him wrong. They had a world champion, and they didn't hold him because they made a bad decision. And to this day, it's something that really pains him and really hurts him, because he had the opportunity to defend his world title in front of a Montana crowd and Montana fans, and he lost.
Just to clarify, the fight was stopped because he had a cut on his eye and it was bleeding profusely. But I think it was right before the last round. All he had to do was make it through one more round, and he was ahead on the scorecards.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And Marvin has always claimed that the fight was crooked, and then the fight could have been, you know, was fixed. And I've never found anything to corroborate that. I mean, I looked into Jancic's background and talked with, you know, multiple people who knew him and who were involved in there that night. And I've never been able to find that there was any collusion. It just seems that sometimes a loss is a loss and a win is a win, and there's no massive, you know, hidden conspiracy to it.
Let's go back to the celebration that happened after he won his first title. People from the reservation gathered. He was given, was it a headdress?
Yeah, a ceremonial headdress and a ceremonial lance with feathers. And the feathers were symbolic to imply one feather for each victim, you know, or each person that he had beaten in the ring.
And he was on the reservation. He talked to school children. And I think you found some interesting documentation about his time talking to kids.
I didn't. I'd like to share one or two with you. These were from a creative writing class at Pablo Elementary School.
And what's the date on the newspaper?
April 23rd, 1980. And I'll just read you a few sentences. One of them is from Danny Lefthand, and she's in grade 6. And she writes, Marvin Camel is a winner. He had to practice very hard to win the championship. He proved that you don't have to live in a popular state like California or New York. All you have to do is practice and keep at what you want to do. You might get it all together like Marvin Camel did. We are proud of you, Marvin Camel. And there's a sentence from a girl named Sherry Newton. She was in grade 6, and she says, I am proud to say that he is a member of the same Indian tribe that I am. Mm-hmm. And then one that's is kind of cute and comical is from a Don Mueller in grade 6. He says, I was proud of Marvin Camel because he proved that Montana has something good. He proved that small towns have some good people in them, and if you have the desire to do something, you can do it. I would like to meet him in a store, not in a dark alley at night. I wish he would visit me someday. And that's just a nice little sample of some of the letters and the kids were working on at that time in their classes.
So he was a really big deal.
He was, yeah. He absolutely was. He was... You know, he was a tremendous source of pride in Montana for so many years. And his name carried so much weight and significance and symbolism and clout. And he was an integral part of the cultural life of Montana. It wasn't just a sporting life. Marvin Camel transcended sports, you know. You didn't have to be in the boxing and the brutality of boxing to like Marvin Camel or to cheer him on or to want something good to happen to him and for him. Marvin Camel's name, I mean, it was synonymous with Montana. In fact, there was a boxer I spoke to. When I brought up Marvin's name, he said to me, his nickname should have been Montana because we knew who he was, that he was Montana. And I think he was a hero here, a necessary hero for so many years. He's a landscaper by trade now. And he mows 200, 300 lawns a week with his own hands by himself. And some days he'll be out there on his mower or his push mower.
In Florida.
In Florida, yeah, northern Florida. And someone will run out with a book in their hand. I know you, you know, this is what you did, you know. And so I think there were a lot of people that were surprised. I went down there a couple of years ago and I sat in on one of the card games that Marvin was having with the fellows, and they were ribbing him, and I thought they seemed to take it a little too far at times. One of the gentlemen there who was kind of ribbing him said that the belt that Marvin won was no greater accomplishment or feat than winning in the local horseshoe tournament at the Lake Francis Estates.
Whoa.
Right.
He knew nothing about what it takes to train to be a boxer.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think many people know. And I'll tell you an interesting story was that I did the whole thing kind of on spec, you know,
writing the book?
On spec. You know, mm-hmm. In my mind, it was, you know, Marvin was coming back and he was going to return and we're going to resurrect him. And there's going to be this great resurgence of interest in who he is and a revival, and he's going to be on a speaking circuit, and great things are going to happen for him in his life. Food, and I never met him, actually. We had been talking on the phone for years, and one day I said, oh, Marvin, I'm doing this book. And I go down there, and we meet at a place called the Sunrise Grill. And the Sunrise Grill is a little cafe about 5 minutes from Marvin's home. And in this small cafe, there are three pictures on the wall in this one booth by the door. And they have Marvin Camel on them. I'm sure he supplied them to the diner, but he's there. And he sits next to that some mornings. He has his coffee. And he's waiting to be recognized. He wants to be recognized. He wants people to match the photos up on the wall with the gentleman sitting in the booth. And he wants to talk and introduce himself. He wears a hat that says, you know, Marvin Camel with his accomplishment on it, 2-time cruiserweight champion of the world. Some days he'll wear his belt, you know, he'll wear his belt to the cafe. And a part of me didn't know what to think at first, you know. I didn't know if it was something that was, you know, sad or should I be sympathetic. And the more I was around him, I didn't see it that way. I mean, I just saw pride, and I'm beaming with pride exuberant pride, beautiful pride, pride to represent in Montana, pride to represent his people, pride to have represented himself across the world. And I loved it.
What attracted you to write this story?
I read some from Anton Chekhov. He said that heroes were as necessary as the sun. And I think Marvin is heroic, and I know he was a hero here at one point. So my question was always, you know, what happens to a hero after, you know, the limelight shifts, after the spotlight moves? Where's the hero go? And I always thought that this hero deserved something different. And I thought that he deserved something of this stature and this magnitude. He did all the work. I just kind of came along afterwards and waved a few pom-poms, you know.
He was never knocked out, was he?
No. Marvin had something called heart, and in boxing parlance, heart can be a cruel thing. It means that you can take your punishment and your lumps and get beaten and battered and bruised and bloodied and not go out. And he was never knocked out.
You talked to a lot of people on the reservation while you were doing research for this story. What did you find out about what's happening today as compared to when Marvin was growing up?
You know, one of the unintended consequences of the book is that I ended up capturing and recording the last interviews of actress Misty Upham. And I interviewed Misty for the book a few months before she was found dead. And I don't know if you're familiar with Misty's story or not, but Misty had told me and given me some horrific, you know, gruesome insight into growing up in Browning and about an assault that had taken place and how she'd been traumatized physically and sexually and how she was self-violent and suicidal. And that was particularly shocking. And I got into some of the issues about the sexual violence on the reservations. I didn't really want to go in that direction, but it was just one of those things where I couldn't ignore it because three of Marvin's children are incarcerated. One of them for sexually related offenses, the other one for petty crimes and theft. And I felt like it'd be something that we couldn't necessarily circumvent. It wasn't something I wanted to spend a lot of time on or talk about condescendingly, but it exists, and it kind of circles back to the whole point of Marvin's story being an alternative ending, and an alternative to for drugs or isolation or depression or dysfunction. And I thought that again that Marvin's story, when you match it up to some of the horrific things that we hear and see and know about reservation life, that Marvin could perhaps serve as an inspiration for a very disaffected segment of society.
Brian D'Ambrosio lives in Helena, Montana. You'll find more information about him and Warrior in the Ring at our blog, mtpr.org/twq, and on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.